We've definitely got our thing here, Rono. I can easily feel myself slipping more and more ways. A simple world of my own. Nobody but you and me. We've got it together, baby.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Automass Chemistry Building, and not from the YMCA, we welcome you and give a warm welcome to Dr. Ariel Fenster and Dr. Joe Schwartz. Please give a warm hand.
Thank you. Hope you enjoyed our warm-up act. Well, many of you have, of course, come here expecting to see some magic, right? Some of you have come expecting to see some chemistry. You will see both. Why magic of all things? Right? You come here wanting to see things appear, magical things. Yeah, well, we can kind of do that, but, you know, the real beauty of what you're going to see here today is not in the magic, it is in the chemistry. What is it? You know, it's not so easy to describe, easier to show. Chemistry is the study of matter and the changes that matter undergoes. And matter matters. Well, you know, as I said, the interesting thing is the changes that the matter undergoes. From fire and flame to beautiful liquids. Right, well, that's kind of the magic of chemistry. I think you'd agree. Sort of a colorful subject, isn't it? But I'll tell you what is the real magic that you're going to see here today. We first conceived this show 35 years ago. That's the first time that we did it. But the real magic that you're going to see is that we haven't aged one bit. But I can tell you that the same tired old funky lines that worked back then still work today. So, you also come here expecting to see rabbits being pulled out of hats, right? Maybe. But you know what? The truth of the fact is that chemistry is more than pulling rabbits out of hats. What we really do is pull molecules out of flasks. Want to see some molecules come out of flasks? A flask. How about a nice long molecule? Like this one. Oh, yeah, but that's figurative. What about seeing some real molecules come out of a real flask?
At least we're going to try to achieve that. And here I've got two solutions, and I would like you to remember the names of this solution. One is called A. And the other one is called C. So let's get the two together. And let's see what we can pull out.
It looks kind of slimy.
In fact, these two solutions were polyvinyl alcohol and borax, and actually that's the way slime is made. You add a green dye to it, and it looks even more disgusting.
And you might think that it's kind of curious that we kind of mix chemistry and magic, right? Chemistry is a hard science rooted in the physical laws of nature. Magic is something else. In magic, we expect the audience to suspend their belief, right? Because magicians do things that are completely contrary to the laws of nature. And of course, in magic, we never explain how something is done. It tantalizes the mind of the audience, right? The whole idea is not to know how these things work. Whereas in chemistry, of course, we do quite the opposite. We relish in providing the explanation. Well, a lot of the stuff that we do here, admittedly, may appear mysterious. And in fact, in some cases, it even looks confusing. And then there are those things that in chemistry, what we're really doing is performing witchcraft. And, you know, I can't really blame them, because some of the stuff that we do really does look like witchcraft.
But there is a big difference between magic and chemistry, because after all, the magician, when he does his trick, will not reveal how it's done, because then it loses all its magic. On the other hand, with chemistry, it seems like magic, but we can give you explanation. So here I've got my magic solution. Well, maybe not enough magic solution. Let's add a little bit more to it. And let's look at some of my magic powder to that. Wow, that's nothing. Let's take the color out. Let's put it back in. Now, that's difficult. I'm going to take it from the bottom. Throw it in the air and catch it right here. Well, I told you this is chemistry, so I can tell you how this is done. This is what's called a clock reaction, and it's a reaction that involves both iodine and iodine. And when iodine is formed, it reacts with starch, which is present, and it gives you a blue complex, and this is a color that you can actually see. And it can go back and forth for about 15 times or so.
Well, hopefully as we go through the performance here today, you're going to see some more eye-popping demonstrations like that. But the fact is that chemistry is, of course, more than eye-popping demonstrations. But we do have a problem, and I'll admit that to you. We have an image problem. Why? Because when people think of chemistry, very often they think of mad scientists. Or if not that, they think of nerds. Indeed, I've even heard it said that people think that chemists are a completely different breed altogether. And then there are those who think that it's the work of the devil. Why? Because they look and they see toxins all over the place. Everything is full of chemicals, and the word chemical has become associated with poison, which is, of course, unfortunate. Because chemicals are not good or bad. They don't make any decisions. They are just things. We're the ones who make decisions. But if you don't have a proper understanding of what molecules can and cannot do, that's when you panic. That's when people get all anxious. So that's one of our problems. But there's another problem. And that is that so many students think that chemistry is a boring subject. It really isn't. All you have to do is study it and look into it. And you see the excitement. And you'll see also the satisfaction that comes. But there's more than satisfaction. The beauty of chemistry is that it is an applied science. In fact, it is the science that is the thread that ties all of the others together. It is practical every single day. We make decisions all the time. Life is full of decisions, right? You get up in the morning, you decide, do you put butter or margarine on your toast? Are you going to drink a diet drink or a regular drink? Do you drink tap water or do you drink bottled water? These are all scientific decisions. They are based on chemistry. They are based on knowing molecules and what they can and cannot do. But what is truly amazing about our science is that we know so much about how things work, drugs, foods, cosmetics, without ever having seen a molecule. They're way too small to be seen. Oh yeah, we have models, we can show you that, but no one sees molecules. Everything we know is by inference. Oh, we do use models. I mean, yeah, we do that. And, you know, these are the kind of things. We use balls, colored balls, to represent atoms, and the string to show the bonds. Some bonds are long, some bonds are short, right? And we carry out chemical reactions, you know, by taking long bonds, converting them into short bonds, etc. You know, that's, you get the idea. And then, of course, we also do some novel reactions where you take short bonds and make them into long bonds. It's a very curious business how, you know, all of that works. It's really hard to figure out just how it all works. You go into the lab and you do some research and you take the long bonds and the short bonds and you try to mix them up and see how it all works like that. Long bonds, short bonds, bonds, no bonds. I don't know. For 35 years I haven't been able to figure out how that one works. But the thing with models like this, you can appreciate the fact that there's a tremendous amount of space in between the atoms. In fact, the truth is that we are mostly empty space, believe it or not. I know that you probably say not. So let me demonstrate. I'm going to need a volunteer. Oh, the gentleman here was quick off the trigger. Come on over here into the spotlight. Have you ever in your life been tied up?
No.
Never? Where are your parents? Why not? All right. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask you to put your hands above your head for a moment while I reach around. You're going to face the audience so they can see all this nonsense. And I'm going to reach around you like that and bring the rope around. You can now hold this. And I also have over here a very large needle. We're going to thread rope through this needle. And I'm going to ask you to hold the needle at the bottom. That's it. Okay, so what have we done so far? We've tied a rope around him. I told you that we're mostly empty space. Now, if that is true, then I should be able to pull that rope right through. If it isn't true, then we're going to have a neat little demo called The Great Divide. Do you really need him or... All right, are you ready? Hold it a bit lower. 1, 2, 3.
Don't you know it feels
magic? Feel that? Hang on a sec. You by any chance read Chinese? So I won't give you my Chinese book. But I will give you my newest one. All right, now we have a bit of an understanding of what atoms and molecules are all about. How do we learn about these things? We learn by looking in a chemistry book. Now, many of you have, of course, think, that's not interesting.
Well, I know that some of these, especially the older chemistry books, are not too interesting. You know, it's black and white, not too many pictures. And whatever picture they have also are black and white. But once you get into it, it's totally different. And you realize that, in fact, chemistry is a very hard topic.
It's more than a hot topic. It's applied every day of our life. You get up in the morning, you open your eyes, you look down over your polyester sheets. You appreciate them. You have to iron them. They're quick to wash. Then you plunk your feet down on your nylon carpeting as you scamper over it and sit down in the bathtub and enjoy some of the chemistry there. But there are some problems, because that bathwater may contain some calcium or magnesium. These are what we call the hardness minerals, and when you put soap into that water, the soap will react with those minerals and form a precipitate, the classic bathtub ring. Nothing to do with your dirt. It's purely the reaction between soap and minerals in the water. But there are interesting issues to talk about here.
Well, actually, depending on where you live in Canada, the water can be either very hard, lots of calcium and magnesium, that's what happens in Montreal, or it can be very soft, very little calcium and magnesium. For instance, out west, the water is very, very soft, no calcium, no magnesium. Here in Montreal, it's different. So what I want you to see, this has been sent, flown in especially for us this morning from Vancouver. Let's see what happens when it arrives in Montreal. Will you call this hard water?
So you don't want to use soap in hard water, but of course chemistry can rise to the occasion because we've come up with detergents. The difference between a soap and a detergent is that detergents do not react with the minerals in the water. You don't have to worry about the bathtub ring. You don't have to worry about a scum when you wash your hair. Detergents are really, really interesting items.
Well, there are all sorts of different type of detergent on the market. There is even one in France that is called Ariel. They took my name because I'm so good. Anyways, here is one that just came out, Splash. Have you heard of Splash? Well, this one is really actually quite amazing. It's also a very interesting ingredient, BHA, BHT, PHD, some more interesting even than other. And actually, I'd like to show you how well they work in hard water, like in Montreal. Okay? Because this detergent has something very special. The box can also be used as a washing machine. And what I have here, I've got some of my wash. That's going to be difficult to remove. I put it in my washing machine. Now it's pretty small, so I really have to push it way down. Let's look at this one, methylene blue. Made these spots just before. Let's put it also in the washing machine. Let's see how well we do. And I can't go home with this. So let's put it also in the washing machine. Next time I'll get a bigger washing machine. Okay, let's close the top. The wash cycle. Amazing, isn't it? Now let's check what came out. That was the one that was all the multicolored, the blue, all completely clean. And look at the last one, also completely clean. You're not amazed? Usually when I do that, people jump up and down and scream. Yeah, I know what you think. It's in the box. No, there's nothing in there. Oh, you want me to open the other side? Okay. No, it's nothing there. both sides. Okay, I'll open both sides. You want me to turn it? Oh, I see what you want me to do.
See, those are the kind of detergents that you need when you have to do some heavy-duty laundry, like diapers, right? Nobody enjoys doing that. And these days, of course, you don't have to do that because we have the disposable variety. Makes kids happier, and amazingly, there's some chemistry involved too.
Well, in fact, you know, there is this controversy between cotton diaper and disposable diaper. There are many people that believe that the disposable diaper are much better for the environment because cotton diaper, you have to grow the cotton, you use pesticide, you use fertilizer and like, you have to wash, use energy. Now, on the other hand, one thing that is non-questionable, if you ask babies, 99.99% of babies prefer disposable diapers. Why? Because they are much more comfortable. You see, the problem with cotton diaper is the cotton is what we call hydrophilic. It picks up moisture. It picks up, say, urine, and it's the urine stays in contact with the baby's skin. And it's very harsh, and as a result, the baby gets a diaper rash. Okay? The advantage of the disposable diaper is that you can deal with this thing with the envelope, which is made out of polypropylene. But there is something else in diaper. There is a material which is very, very effective. And I'm going to show you this by, let's imagine that this is a disposable diaper, and this is just some baby byproduct that was given to me this morning. And let's see what happens. Do you understand why the liquid is not coming down? This is because of the centrifugal force. I'm turning it so quickly that doesn't have time to do it. Actually, there is another explanation. And I'm going to repeat this experiment with the material that is found in diapers, in the central part of the diaper. It's a material known as sodium polyacrylate, and it has the ability of absorbing large amount of liquid. So what you're seeing here is what was at the bottom of my styrofoam cup. Now you know that there are diapers for boys and diapers for girls. One is blue and the other one is pink. Now, actually, you need very little of this material, so it has to be placed strategically, okay? Because I hope you know that anatomically, girls and boys are different, okay? So you place it in a different spot for very, very small amount.
You know, these sodium polyacrylate molecules can have different lengths, different molecular weights, as we term it. And some of them, the longer molecules, are even better at absorbing moisture than the one that you just saw. These are the ones that are used on the stage when you want to have snow. All of a sudden, you need a snowstorm on the stage. Of course, you can't do that with real snow, but you can do it with sodium polyacrylate. Look at this.
Let's say, for instance, you want to shoot a movie, a winter movie, in July. Unless you live in Quebec, it's difficult to find snow in July. But you can, using sodium polyacrylate, the same material as that you find in diaper. But the powder, this time, the grain, if you want, are slightly larger. So the effect is somewhat different. Snow?
Exactly what was missing in your life, right? Snow. Well, some of the other everyday items that rely on chemistry, things like deodorants. There's a lot of research that goes into finding the right chemicals to take away those particular things. Or if you want to get a hair permanent, a lot of science there too. What happens there is that you disrupt the sulfur-sulfur bonds that hold together protein molecules, and you then rearrange the hair and you oxidize it and you get the new shape. So it's fundamental chemistry, but of course it is fascinating stuff. But where things really get interesting is when we start talking about beverages and foods. Because we all drink, we all eat, we all enjoy that particular type of chemistry. Well, let's take a look at beverages first, because there's so many, many different kinds. How do you make them?
Well, I have a friend of mine. He was a waiter in a cafe, and he was terribly overweight. People had all these different orders. He just couldn't catch up. So you know what he decided to do? He decided to take a chemistry course, and then it became very, very simple. Like somebody will ask for some water. Well, water, that's pretty straightforward. What about you, sir? Would you rather have some wine, strange-looking wine? Or maybe, no, you don't want any wine. That's not too good for you. Maybe you would rather have some milk. That's pretty good. Or what about you, sir? What would you like to have instead? Well, maybe some really good beer. That could be also very, very pleasant.
Well, so much for beverages. But where things get really exciting is when we start looking at the food that we eat. There are a lot of questions that come up about the food that we eat. People are worried about these days, especially about the additives, because they've heard stories about how it can cause hyperactivity in children. And they have all these visions of some nefarious chemists locked up in laboratories just thinking about what new food additive they can put into the food to unleash on the unsuspecting public. Well, of course, the fact is that everything in the world is made up of chemicals. Chemicals are not good or bad. They're not safe or dangerous. There are safe ways and dangerous ways to use chemicals. Consider something like an apple. Better yet, more than consider it, let's take a bite out of it. What is it that you're really tasting? You're tasting a whole collage of chemicals. That is what you're tasting. Dozens and dozens of different compounds. These are not additives. Those are the natural building blocks of the apple. That's what it's made of. I'll call your attention to a couple of these. There's acetone in there. Well, the last time you encountered that was probably on the label of your nail polish remover, where it tells you poison, do not drink. And yet here it is in the apple. Are you going to die if you eat that apple? Well, even if you do, it's quite economical because it also contains formaldehyde, so you will be pre-embalmed. And then there is alcohol in there. Are you going to get drunk? Of course not. Why? Because, as Paracelsus told us 500 years ago, only the dose makes the poison. The amount of acetone in there is trivial. The amount of formaldehyde is trivial. All of the good compounds in the apple, the antioxidants, etc., far outweigh those. But what is that apple really made up beside all of these compounds? Well, we have the flavors, and some of those were in that list. But we also have a lot of sugar in that apple. How much? About this much. That's a significant amount of sugar. And then, of course, we also have a lot of water. Now, I know that you probably don't really appreciate these values and their ratios and what the composition of the apple really is, so we'll show you. We'll make an apple. How does that sound? From chemicals.
We'll make an apple from scratch. Well, let's try to remember what Joe mentioned, that there is an apple. Yeah, we have got sugar. Oh, let's add some. Oh, yeah, first we're going to do it in this. We're going to do it in a chemical box. Let's put some sugar. That's about right. Water. There was water. There was the water. And then there are 500 different chemicals. And believe it or not, they're all in there. Maybe you don't notice them because, as it was mentioned, they are present in very, very small amounts. So let's put them all here in our pot. Oh, I'm sorry, there is a little bit left. Okay. So you agree, I definitely put all the chemicals that are required. And we have made apples.
Now you know how apples are made, right? Well, in all seriousness, there's nothing to worry about in an apple. There are no problematic compounds in there. But there are some questions that arise when we're talking about processed foods. That's a different kind of a story, because here we have some compounds that perhaps should raise a few eyebrows. Like what? Well, what do we have in there? We have a large array of compounds, including some noodles. But the next one is one that does introduce a problem. That, of course, is salt. This is one of the big problems with processed foods. They do contain a lot of salt. But once again, one picture is worth 1,000 words, and one live demo is worth 1,000 pictures.
So let's check how much salt there is in Lipton chicken noodle soup. Weren't you amazed? Actually, there were some noodles in there. Here I've got my salt meter. This is just water. Nothing happened because you know that water does not conduct electricity. Well, let's add some salt. Okay. You notice how much salt I put in there? Fair amount. Okay, you ready? I would suggest that you put your sunglasses on. That gives you an idea how much salt there is in Lipton chicken noodle soup.
Well, now you get some idea of the wide array of roles that chemicals play in our lives. But the really interesting question is, how do we know all of this? How did we arrive at this modern day and age where we can solve so many problems while creating some smaller ones? So let's go back in time to time when there was nothing, till someone up there said, "Let there be light," and pretty soon the earth was created. And then another pretty good trick was performed, and man was created. Well, we still don't really understand that whole process, although we are beginning to learn a little bit about, you know, things like test tube babies and the whole concept of cloning. So, you know, we are starting to get a handle on this. But early man didn't know anything about this. He looked around and he was amazed of all of the chemical action that was going on around him. Of course, he didn't perceive it as chemical action. He looked in one direction, and there were geysers erupting. Well, you've probably never seen that. If you haven't been to a national park or you haven't been to California, you've not seen a geyser reacting. Here's your lucky day. What we have in the bottle here is a little bit of hydrogen peroxide, H2O2. Hydrogen peroxide breaks down to water and oxygen under the influence of a catalyst, manganese dioxide. The reaction produces a great deal of heat. It's what we call an exothermic reaction. In fact, the reaction is so exothermic that the water will begin to boil. And as you know, when water boils, of course, it changes into steam. And as it condenses back into liquid droplets, you get a cloud. That's what we see starting to form here. And as the heat builds up and more water evaporates, we get the effect of the geyser. Here it comes. To California, you may see it on a bigger scale, but not nearly as entertaining as that. So, he looked in one direction, he saw geysers erupting, he looked in another direction, he saw all kinds of fruits growing. Well, What do you do with that? You take it and you squeeze it and you let the juice ferment. Here is a 3,000-year-old grape squeezer. 3,000 years old. We still do that, of course. We still squeeze grapes to make wine. Of course we do. But today we have a far more sophisticated method of doing that. And not only that, we can do it to music. We still, of course, enjoy wine today. Obviously we do. And who better to talk about wine than a real Frenchman? And Ariel comes from France, so we're going to let him speculate about wine.
Well, I always feel I have to stand up when I hear this. So I just would like to share with you the story of a friend of mine who actually, like many Frenchmen, did love wine. More specifically, he liked white wine. But the problem is that he had read that white wine is not especially good for one's health. What's good is the red wine because of the resveratrol which is present. So he had in his cellar a large amount of white wine, and he really did not know what to do with it. But, you know, he was a chemist. So he managed to take his white wine and turn it into red wine. So let's check how he did that. He took his white wine, added a few chemicals together, and got red wine. But then he had problem. He was getting headaches because red wine is rich in histamine. And histamine is a vasodilator. It gives headaches. So now he had all this red wine and he didn't know what to do with it. He said, okay, I'm going to go back to white wine. Well, again, fortunately, because he knew chemistry, he was able to take all his red wine and turn it back into white wine. So you remember what was done? He started with white wine, turned it to red wine, and because of the chemistry, went back to white wine.
Yeah, man is pretty inventive when it comes to drinking alcohol, right? He knows exactly how to go about doing that. But there's a problem here, and the problem is that too much alcohol can do you in. It doesn't have to be red wine, other kinds of beverages as well. People don't realize, you know, just how much alcohol is in beverages like beer, whiskey, etc., and how difficult it is to drive when you use these things. And sometimes, you know, we think that we just might be better off if we didn't have any of that alcohol at all. But of course, the truth is that, with everything else, it is a question of amount. Alcohol in small doses can be quite good. Larger amounts, it's a real problem. But it's been around a long time. The process of fermentation is probably the oldest chemical process known. In fact, it's even older than making soap. That's the second oldest because man's desire to be drunk older than his desire to be clean, obviously. Interesting. Alcohol, of course. But our ancient friends had more than alcohol of interest. I mean, they knew how to grow grapes, other crops, etc. They looked around. They saw many interesting things. For example, plants. This particular plant, it's called the madder plant. The root of this plant gives you a red dye, madder. It was the stuff that was used in the red coats of soldiers in the British Army, for example. And it's still sometimes used, but it's one of the most ancient dyes. For example, it would have been used in Joseph's coat of many colors. Have you ever wondered about that? I mean, how did they, thousands and thousands of years ago, manage to make these brilliantly colored fabrics? They had to rely on nature.
And the chemistry of nature. And it's really amazing how many different colors they were able to create. All sort of colors, some brighter than others. And now we've created all these different colors. Let's see what we can do with it. Let's mix them together again. Okay, now let's pause. What did we start with? A clear solution. What's going to happen if we mix all these colors back together again? Let's guess.
Joseph's coat of many colors, though, got him into trouble. And it got his descendants into trouble, too. Because they were made to work in the land of Egypt as slaves until, of course, Moses came along and stuck his staff into the Nile River, turned it red with blood, and at that point the Pharaoh said, enough, take your people and go. And go they did. They left the land of Egypt, and they wandered through the desert. They wandered through the Sinai desert for 40 long years with very little food and very little water. Until one day they came upon a pond in the Sinai desert, this very pond that's still there today, and they started to drink from the water of that pond. And it was bitter. It was alkaline. It's all recorded right there in the Bible. What were they to do? Moses turned to his research director and said, God, what do we do? And that research director gave some good advice. Sometimes research directors do that. And he said, go take the pieces of wood that are lying beside that pond and throw them into the water, and the water will be sweet. And so it was. How so? Water in the desert leaches minerals from the soil, alkaline minerals. So it becomes basic. Wood that lies out in the sun for a long time is oxidized. It forms acids. Moses took the acidic wood, threw it into the basic water, performed history's first recorded titration, neutralized the base with the acid. Another problem chemically solved. Well, of course, there were many other such chemical problems and solutions all over the world, not only restricted to the Middle East. The Chinese, for example, were into gunpowder. They found that if you took sulfur and charcoal and saltpeter and mixed those together, you got something we call gunpowder. Well, gunpowder is, of course, chemical that has had a tremendous effect on our history. What does it do?
Well, let's add a little bit of gunpowder, and let's start it with some other material we call nitrocellulose. I would like to notice a difference between the two, nitrocellulose, also known as smokeless powder, and black powder. Smokeless powder, black powder.
That was a Chinese invention. And as I said, it changed the course of history. Because now people, of course, could kill each other with much, much greater efficiency. At the same time, in Europe, things were going on a different track. European alchemists were interested in something other than explosives. Believe it or not, they were interested in gold. Because gold never rusted, it seemed to be eternal. It never aged. They thought that if somehow they could isolate the secret of gold, they could use it on themselves. So the alchemists searched for what we call aurum potabile, drinkable gold, the key to longevity. They took base metals like lead, mixed them with others like mercury, hoping to turn it into gold. Of course, it never happened. Lead is still lead, the alchemists are long dead, and there's been no success along those lines. However, out of that bizarre practice of alchemy grew the modern science of chemistry. Where the starting date is, it's hard to say. But Joseph Priestley is one of the markers of the beginning of modern chemistry because of his discovery of oxygen. He didn't really know it was oxygen. In fact, he called it phlogiston, but nevertheless, his basic experiment, whereby he took mercuric oxide and heated it up and found that it released a gas, is a pivotal landmark in the history of chemistry. And then things started to move along very, very quickly. For example, Humphrey Davy in England introduced the idea of the public lecture. It wasn't enough just to do chemistry in the lab, the public had to be let in on it. Humphrey Davy, his favorite demonstration was nitrous oxide. And here's a classic cartoon of Davy with an impish grin on his face demonstrating nitrous oxide to an unfortunate member of the audience who sees the gas pass right through his body, making an exciting exit. Davy was a brilliant scientist, but he is probably best known for introducing to the world Michael Faraday, who was his student, who turned out to be possibly the greatest scientist who has ever lived in terms of the number of discoveries he made, the different areas in which he developed expertise, including the public lecture. People flocked every Friday night to the Royal Institution in London to partake of Davy's phenomenal experiments. Today, of course, with TV and the internet, things are not quite as exciting, and you can't drag as many people out to public lectures as Davy used to do, but maybe we just have to outdo him and do stuff that he wasn't able to do. For example, conjure up a genie. Oh, he may have done his classic experiments, but conjuring up a genie, that's a different story. See if we can have a shot at that. Genies don't like to be seen, but I can catch one for you in this glass. Okay, here's what we need to do. I need to take some genie molecules and squeeze them together and toss them up and catch it in my glass right here. Are you ready? Ready, genie. Would you expect a real genie? Michael Faraday's impact was tremendous. But there were many others who made very, very significant contributions, including a young 16-year-old boy, William Henry Perkin. Perkin was searching for a substitute for quinine, which in those days, of course, was needed for battling malaria. Well, he thought that there might be a chance of taking some chemicals isolated from coal tar, mixing them together and coming up with quinine, because the chemical formula of quinine seemed to be similar to aniline, which was isolated from coal tar. But he was stymied all the time. He wasn't able to come up with quinine. But one day, he threw all of his chemicals into the sink. And much to his surprise, a brilliant new color formed, a color called mauve. He had never seen anything like that, the color mauve. It was a brand new substance. They had all the natural colors that I already told you about, but there was nothing like mauve. It became extremely popular. Ladies wanted to wear mauve, especially the queen. If it was good for the queen, everyone wanted it. And postage stamps of the era were colored mauve. If you collect stamps, you can go back and check that in the 1860s. The penny royals, they were called, were colored mauve. If you stopped on a street corner, a policeman would come up to you, tell you to move on. Perkin became a wealthy man based upon his discovery of mauve. The discovery, as I said, happened at a very early stage of his life. He was 16 when that was made. But luckily, he had a father who had some money, and he borrowed money to build a factory. Well, the factory was built just outside of London. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore, although historically, of course, it was a fascinating venue. But at first, the factory was just an empty shell of a building. Of course, with nothing in it. But he built the factory around large chemical containers because he had found that taking these solutions from petroleum, he was able to synthesize various colors. And the question was, can you take these things and do anything with them commercially? That was the real question. So he took his blues and his mauves and poured them together. And it was a commercial success because out of those dyes came fabrics, beautiful colors, mauves, purples, reds, pink, gold, silver. Of course, what happens when you color so much fabric with so little dye that you run out of the color? So what did he do? He went back into the lab
to make some more synthetic dye. And I think we're going to try to duplicate what Perkins did. We have the reaction, but actually this reaction works best with music. No. No, not that music. No. We need something more energetic. See? With the right music, it actually does work.
At the same time that Perkin was carrying his experiments out in Europe, in the United States, Charles Goodyear was making an impact. You probably heard of him because he was named after that blimp that you sometimes see at football games. Well, he was very interested in rubber. Rubber is a natural material, is the exudate of a tree. However, it isn't easy to use the way that it comes out of the tree, because it melts very, very easily. It isn't particularly resilient. But Goodyear found a way to solve this problem. Turned out that when you take rubber and you heat it together with sulfur, you make something called vulcanized rubber. And sulfur is a substance that is very, very often used in chemistry. In fact, my assistant backstage here, Professor Harp, is a sulfur chemist. And he was around to help Goodyear do his job back then. So anyway, Goodyear found a way to make this stuff, the vulcanized rubber. And its properties are very, very different from the natural material.
I'm sorry, Joe. We're having a problem here. The color is not steadfast.
It's gone?
Yeah, the color is gone.
Well, get it back.
I think we need some more music to get it back. And then it comes back. But, you know, to have to go all the time, shake, 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 it's a little bit difficult.
All right, well, the rubber, the interesting properties.
Properties of rubber. Rubber is resilient, means that you can stretch it. And because of the work of Goodyear, it became even more resilient. And you can make interesting balloons, other things as well. Here I've got a balloon. Here I've got a needle. A needle, a balloon.
So by the late 1800s, chemistry was starting to come together, right? We were understanding how rubber worked. Later on in Canada, we went on to use it for national defense. But in the late 1800s, there were all kinds of interesting discoveries that were being made. Friedrich Schönbein, a Swiss chemist, was at the forefront of one of these. Schönbein, one day, spilled some nitric and sulfuric acid on the floor. And he apparently did this work at home, or at least so the legend has it. Luckily, Frau Schönbein wasn't in the kitchen at the time. And he decided that, gee, you know, he better clean up this mess. And he grabbed his wife's cotton apron, which happened to be hanging, you know, on the wall. And then he had the wet apron on his hands. He had to dry it. Then he noticed something interesting when he put it in front of the fireplace to dry. That's what he saw. You want to see that again? Whether you're talking to kindergarten kids or PhDs, they want to see things burn. Nitrocellulose is what it is. Reacting nitric acid, sulfuric acid with cellulose. Does that. Well, Schönbein looked at that, and it gave him an idea. It didn't produce any smoke. And thus was born smokeless gunpowder, which is still the same stuff that we use today. But in France, Count Chardonnay had another idea for this material. He found that it would dissolve in alcohol, and that if you pass this solution through a spinneret, which is like a shower head, you would get fibers. And they were beautiful-looking fibers when the solvent evaporated. It's called Chardonnay silk. It was the world's first artificial silk. But there was a problem with it, as you can imagine. The fabric that was used was extremely flammable. And workers in the factory took to calling it mother-in-law silk. Some of you sometime in your life will relate to this. So things really started to come into place. And then along came Mendeleev, who said it was time to systematize chemistry, which of course he did with the classic periodic table, which is still the very representation of chemistry. If you want to know more about the periodic table, we can turn to Tom Lear and his classic song.
Now, if I may digress momentarily from the mainstream of this evening's symposium, I'd like to sing a song which is completely pointless, but is something which I picked up during my career as a scientist. This may prove useful to some of you someday, perhaps in a somewhat bizarre set of circumstances. It's simply the names of the chemical elements set to a possibly recognizable tune. Silicon and silver and samarium and bismuth, lithium, beryllium and barium. Isn't that interesting? I knew you would. I hope you're all taking notes because there's going to be a short quiz next period. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum and magnesium and sprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum and plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, metallum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium and fermium, berkelium and also mendelevium, isladium, nobelium and argon, krypton, radon, xenon, zinc and rhodium and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
Tom Lear, of course, was a Harvard mathematician who wrote some wonderful songs. You can still find them. You can find them on the web and download them. Wonderful array of semi-satirical kind of songs. So anyway, by the end of the 1800s and going into the 1900s, chemistry was riding high. The slogan was, better living through chemistry, and nobody raised any eyebrows about that one because they were all of the benefits. It was only quite recently that we started to see this equating of chemistry with toxins and poisons because you know, in those days, the benefits were absolutely clear cut. Nylon was introduced in 1939 at the New York World's Fair, and what a fascinating material that was. For the first time in the laboratory, a commercially viable synthetic material was put together, polymers, very, very long molecules. Wallace Carruthers, the American, was the inventor of this. And what we're really talking about here is taking very small molecules, two different kinds actually, and joining them together to make a long chain. Well, that's one thing to describe it. You can see it on picture, the two solutions mixed together, the nylon forming at the interface. But of course, it's much more dramatic to see it in real life.
So here again, I need two solutions. The first one is called A. And the second one is called B. And as it was mentioned, the nylon forms at the interface of these two solutions. It's like oil and water. They do not mix, but they react in between the two. So let's pick up the fiber. Can you come here? Or one of you. Okay, take the beaker and bring it down, but make sure it doesn't touch the side. Okay.
A lot of nylon coming out of that.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
But of course, the real beauty of nylon is what you can do with it. All kinds of commercial applications. One of the first items ever made out of nylon was the toothbrush, the bristles. Because before that, they used to be pulled from the back of pigs. Pig bristles were used in toothbrushes. Pigs didn't like that. Right? So when nylon was introduced, it was a big relief. And then, of course, there was the nylon stocking introduced in 1941 at Macy's. Ladies stood in line around the block on Nylon Day, as it was called, to get the new stockings. They couldn't even wait to get home to try it on. And then there was the parachute made of nylon. That changed the course of the war because the U.S. was cut off from the silk supplies in the Orient. Silk was the classic material for parachutes, but nylon was now available. Again, a fascinating turning point in our history. By the 1960s, these materials, like the plastics, had been infused into our lives. If you remember the classic line from The Graduate, when a family friend corrals Benjamin, who has just graduated from university, puts an arm around him and pulls him over to the corner and says, Benjamin, I have just one word to say to you, as he was launching out on a prospective career. He said, plastics. Well, it turned out that Benjamin was more interested in Mrs. Robinson than was interested in plastics. But this is when the world first realized the popularity of these materials. And today, of course, they're all over the place. But there are also issues about the plastics, as you know. Some of them are biodegradable. We have worries about some chemicals leaching out, but still the benefits dramatically outweigh any of the detriments. We pay for those plastics with plastic, right? PVC is used to make the credit cards, and you know what? We also, in some parts of the world, use currency that is made of plastic.
Actually, if you live in Australia or New Zealand or in Thailand, you already use plastic money. What a surprise. An Australian $5 bill in my wallet. Who would have thought? Well, this is made out of polypropylene, high-density propylene, and I'd just like to show you how strong this material is. I need two strong guys. Oh, yeah, they're both very strong. I can check that, see that. Let me check your muscles. No, that's okay. Yeah. Wow. You're like, oh, wow. Okay. So look, what I'm going to ask you to do, you each grab one side of this $5 bill. Actually, in Canadian money, it's $250. That's a good question. Well, let's try to see if you can rip it. So what I want you is right, you grab it very strong from either side. You from one side. Now, first make sure you hold it very strong. And look around there, look at the people, and pull! 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 Pull!
Look, he's lifting you up!
Okay, guys, you can give it to me because, in fact, it's impossible to tear it. No. And you'll have heard it here first. In 2 years' time, Canadian money is also going to be made out of plastic.
So you guys, you ask your mom to give you some money to practice that trick on. So it's coming. It's coming. But you know, one of the big problems we face with all of these plastics and with many of the other substances that we make, the medications, food additives, etc., is that we have to rely on oil. And we have a love affair with oil, right? But the fact is that the Earth is a finite size, so we have a fixed amount of oil. Eventually, we are going to run out. We are going to have an energy crisis. We are going to have to look for new sources of oil. And we figured that maybe we're going to try that right here. We're going to try to make some synthetic oil.
Well, I don't know if we can manage to do that. It's quite difficult. Here I've got three solutions, 1, 2, 3, that's simple. And what we're going to do is mix 1 into 2, 2 back into 1. We'll do that a couple of times. And we're going to mix it into 3. We'll add 3 to it. Here it is, sorry. I have difficulty counting. What have we got here? No, we don't want gold. We want
black gold.
Yeah, come on. Will gold do?
We'll have to do.
Okay.
We'll have to do. Out of this stuff, we make all kinds of things, commodities for everyday life. Let me show you. I have my factory here. Nothing in there. Of course, we like to use technical terms for describing things like that. Empty. A few drops of our oil. And out come fish. Oily fish. Fish that are made of plastic. Right? Because our plastic is made of oil. But as I told you, plastics also give us problems. Right? They give us problems. But the nice thing about the ingenuity of chemistry is that just like that, we can solve those problems. We talked about molecules. Well, they're made of plastic. There's a reversal, right? And items like the medications that we use, the shampoos that we use, those also rely on petroleum. But I see you're not happy because I pulled out all of these things. And after all, it is sort of a magic show, and you've been thinking rabbit all the time. Is it possible to bring a rabbit out from oil? Let's give it a shot. Obviously, though, the only kind of rabbit that you can make from petroleum is a synthetic one. Right? But on the other hand, they are a lot easier to keep. I can tell you that. So we're interested in all kinds of things, obviously, as chemists, and we're still not done. We're interested in it, believe it or not, even in insects. We are interested in the love life of insects. Insects communicate with each other through specific chemicals called pheromones. One member of the species will waft it into the air, another one picks it up and is enticed to engage in some activity.
Usually in the insect world, it's a female that actually emits the pheromone to attract the male. And this has been used to actually make replace pesticide. You see, what you can do is actually you can saturate an area with the pheromone. The male insect flies over it, smells a female, but can't find her, and eventually dies from exhaustion. I just want to show you how powerful these pheromones are. Here I have a representation of a pheromone. Just before the show, we have released a few dozen mosquitoes in the audience. Yeah, that's what stung you, yeah? And we'll see how effective it is. What's going to happen is that we're going to get the insect to come and drink of the pheromone from right here. Moreover, we have taught them to drink from a straw, believe it or not. And let's see how if it works. Oh, I feel them buzzing. They're coming. Oh, my God, look at this. They're really thirsty this time, huh? Now, actually, this is used, the way it's used truly, it's not used to control insects because it would require too much pheromone, but it's used in traps to determine the infestation, the degree of infestation. So the farmers every so often comes and checks it out and find out how many insects have been caught. And when there is a maximum, then he will apply the pesticide. So that actually is good. It means that it minimizes the use of pesticide. Aren't you impressed? Actually, they're really thankful, most of them.
So besides insects, what else are we interested in? We are interested in pain. I know our students probably think that we're interested in inflicting pain. No, we're actually interested in solving the problem of pain. And I need a little help here. I need a volunteer. Young lady right there. You're going to help me with solving the problem of pain.
Uh-oh,
it's right. Hi, what's your name?
Andrea,
face the audience. Audience, this is Andrea. Andrea, this is the audience. We will start with some simple questions. Have you ever in your life felt pain?
Yes.
Good. Because then you have some idea of what is going to happen here today. Next question is a bit harder. Have you ever in your life done anything like that?
No.
You have never swallowed a sword?
No.
What school do you go to?
JPPS.
You go to JPPS? My kids went to JPPS. They learned how to swallow swords. This presents a bit of a problem. You know why? Because what I was going to do was to take my sword and ask you to show the audience how you can swallow it without any pain. But I was kind of hoping that you had some experience with this, but you haven't. So we're going to do this a little bit different. I have something here that's called a neck stock. Do you have any idea why this would be called a neck stock? This is called a stock. This is called a neck. This, therefore, goes around your neck. And we're going to lock it up like that. Your parents are here? They're not here? Who are you here with? Your grandparents, they're here? They're right there? Are there more like this at home? Would she be missed if something goes wrong? Turn around so they can see your panicked face. Now, here's the story. You know that soldiers in battle don't feel the wounds of their battle during the battle, only after, because their brain is so engaged that it produces compounds called endorphins. And they take away pain, sort of the body's natural morphine-like chemicals. So when someone is scared, their brain synthesizes these compounds, and they feel no pain whatsoever. So all I need for you is to be scared, which I assume you are. Right? Because you've never swallowed a sword before. You're not swallowing a sword. I told you we were going to do this different, which is the reason I put this next talk on you. Face the audience so they can see your terrified face. And what we're going to do is push this sword right through your neck without you feeling any pain whatsoever. You feel pain?
Yeah.
Okay. And now, you know why she felt pain? Because she didn't believe me. She thought it was a trick. Look what's happening right now. Sword is right through your neck. You ever done anything like that before? There we go. Now, hang on. Come back. Tell me. You read Chinese? You cannot read Chinese. One of these days, I'm going to find someone who can read Chinese. You read English? I'm going to give you this to read. Maybe next year or the year after, you'll be ready for that, okay? Hey, come back. We're not finished yet. I'm going to give you one more thing. Hopefully, it's a gift that's going to stay with you for the rest of your life. That's this applause, which is just for you. She'll recover. The holes here, you know, you have a little water coming out of here the next time you drink, but it's gonna heal. So these are the kind of things that we are interested in. But the truth is that chemistry is really like a double-edged sword. You know, it really is. Because on the one hand, we can create explosions. On the other hand, we can use fertilizers and pesticides and basically feed the world. It all is a question of how we go about doing this. And once more, the problems can be very, very nicely stated by Tom Lear. Listen carefully.
Visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. The halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste.
He got it right. There's a lot of pollution. We even have pollution in this building, as you may have noticed. But that's only because we're undergoing a $40 million renovation. So that's the kind of pollution that I think we can put up with for a short time. But of course, it is a serious business. But it also takes scientific knowledge to know how to battle that and how to counter it. Well, these, though, are the kind of headlines that we see, where chemicals are a problem.
Well, actually, this is really quite depressing for me as a chemist. The morning when I open the newspaper, the way chemistry is presented is in a very negative fashion. Chemistry, toxic, nauseous, smelly. You know what? It makes me so angry. I take my paper, I rip it in small pieces. Because I know that chemistry can be cause problem, but chemistry can also solve this problem. So I want to take my paper and rip it apart because I'm so angry. Chemistry rage. So I take my paper, but I know also that I have to dispose of it in a very ecological manner. So I fold it very neatly, and I'm ready to do it. And I hope that you have learned something throughout this time with us. And I hope that many of the small ones are going to go into science, are going to go into chemistry. And in another 35 years from now, when we're going to do the show again, and I'll open the paper, things are going to be totally different. Things are going to be very exciting. Things are going to be very, very good.
So obviously, see, chemistry has gotten us into trouble. But one thing about us is we never surrender, because chemistry is also the way to get us out of that trouble. Well, we've come a long way on our chemical journey since the early days of the Chinese and their gunpowder and their primitive rockets to today, when, of course, we have traveled to the moon. So why not launch a moon rocket? 3, 2, 1, launch. You just can't get good help these days. You ask them to come up with one good launch. We have traveled in space. We've been to the moon. We've seen an Earth rise. We are playing around with life in the test tube. Amazing accomplishments. The question is, you know, where do we go from here? We are beginning to understand the mysteries of DNA, the mysteries of life itself. What does the future hold? Is it a future with clean water and fertile soil, new sources of oil, a future with fewer nasty bugs, a future with all kinds of miracle drugs? Well, of course, the answer to all of that will come from someone somewhere working in a laboratory, and it will all come through the magic of chemistry. Thank you. But I know you're not happy, because we had a failed rocket launch. And you're not happy because you haven't seen a rabbit. Well, that's maybe because we've been going about it the wrong way. Give it a shot with the... let's try the rocket launch once more. We don't want you to go home with a failed rocket launch, the same way that we don't want you to go home with a failed rabbit. So it's a... The help is working away. He is now fueling the rocket. And now he is ready to launch. 3, 2, 1... Much better. But you know, the trouble with the rabbit, I think, is maybe we've been looking for him in the wrong place. We should have been looking in his natural habitat, which of course is the top hat. Let's give it a shot. Ah. No, I think I've done it. Well, almost. I'm getting better and better at it. Closer and closer. I almost made the whole rabbit, but not quite. But I did make the most important part, because this is... Thank you. Thank you. Hopefully. Thank you. Maybe we'll see you again in another 35 years. Thank you. Anyone interested? Books are out there. I will sign them.